The Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College presents Keeping the Faith with your host, Senior Fellow Joe Wolcott.
Psalm 18. The Lord is my rock and my fortress. To the choirmaster, a psalm of David, the servant of the Lord, who addressed the words of this song to the Lord on the day when the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. He said, I love you, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. I call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised, and I am saved from my enemies. The cords of death encompassed me. The torrents of destruction assailed me. The cords of Sheol entangled me. The snares of death confronted me. In my distress I called upon the Lord. To my God I cried for help. From his temple he heard my voice, and my cry to him reached his ears. Then the earth reeled and rocked. The foundations also of the mountains trembled and quaked because he was angry. Smoke went up from his nostrils, and devouring fire from his mouth. Glowing coals flamed forth from him. He bowed the heavens and came down. Thick darkness was under his feet. He rode on a cherub and flew. He came swiftly on the wings of the wind. He made darkness his covering, his canopy around him. Thick clouds, dark with water. Out of the brightness before him, hailstones and coals of fire broke through the clouds. The Lord also thundered in the heavens, and the Most High uttered his voice, hailstones and coals of fire, and he sent out his arrows and scattered them. He flashed forth lightning and routed them. Then the channels of the sea were seen, and the foundations of the world were laid bare at your rebuke, O Lord, at the blast of the breath of your nostrils. He sent from on high. He took me. He drew me out of many waters. He rescued me from the strong enemy and from those who hated me, for they were too mighty for me. They confronted me in the day of my calamity, but the Lord was my support. He brought me out into a broad place. He rescued me because he delighted in me. The Lord dealt with me according to my righteousness. According to the cleanness of my hands, he rewarded me. For I have kept the ways of the Lord, and have not wickedly departed from my God. For all his rules were before me, and his statutes I did not put away from me. I was blameless before him, and I kept myself from my guilt. So the Lord has rewarded me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands in his sight. With the merciful you show yourself merciful, with the blameless man you show yourself blameless, with the purified you show yourself pure, and with the crooked you make yourself seem torturous. For you save a humble people, but the haughty eyes you bring down. For it is you who light my lamp. The Lord my God lightens my darkness. For by you I can run against a troop, and by my God I can leap over a wall. This God, his way is perfect. The word of the Lord proves true. He is a shield for all those who take refuge in him. For who is God but the Lord, and who is a rock except our God? The God who equipped me with strength and made my way blameless. He made my feet like the feet of a deer and set me secure on the heights. He trains my hands for war so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze. You have given me the shield of your salvation, and your right hand supported me, and your gentleness made me great. You gave a wide place for my steps under me, and my feet did not slip. I pursued my enemies and overtook them, and did not turn back till they were consumed. I thrust them through so that they were not able to rise. They fell under my feet, for you equipped me with the strength for the battle. You made those who rise against me sink under me. You made my enemies turn their backs to me, and those who hated me I destroyed. They cried for help, but there was none to save. They cried to the Lord, but he did not answer them. I beat them fine as dust before the wind. I cast them out like the mire of the streets. You delivered me from strife with the people. You made me the head of the nations. People whom I had not known served me. As soon as they heard of me, they obeyed me. Foreigners came cringing to me. Foreigners lost heart and came trembling out of their fortresses. The Lord lives, and blessed be my rock, and exalted be the God of my salvation, the God who gave me vengeance and subdued peoples under me, who rescued me from my enemies. Yes, you exalted me above those who rose against me. You delivered me from the man of violence. For this I will praise you, O Lord, among the nations, and sing your name. Great salvation he brings to his king, and shows steadfast love to his anointed, to David and his offspring forever. Welcome back to Keeping the Faith. I am your host, Joseph Wolcott, and today we have a fun but important topic to discuss. As humans, we are created in the Imago Dei, in the image of God, and part of that includes the capacity to create. As humans, we are compelled by narrative, whether that be on the page, the screen, or in verbal recitation. So today, we're going to look at the place of narrative in the Christian life, as well as how to engage with narrative in a way that glorifies God the most. Here to help me with that is Dr. Joshua Mayo. Dr. Mayo is the chair and associate professor of English here at the college, where he teaches British literature, composition, and the quote-unquote good books. Feel free to ask him about this favorite term later. He and his wife Bethany, along with their five children, Ezra, Silas, Ainley, Zoe Claire, and Finn live here in the town, in a technical sense. But for most of the year, Dr. Mayo's soul dwells in a little fishing village in Maine called New Harbor. Dr. Mayo feels inspired by Beowulf, confused by Flannery O'Connor, and elated by Dickens. He also loves Grove City College. Dr. Mayo, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Joseph.
All right. So this is going to be fun. Let's just get right into it. So let's kind of just build from the bottom, work our way to some of the particulars. So why do you think we as humans find stories so compelling?
What a good question. I wonder if we could be pluralists about this and imagine probably several different reasons why human beings love stories. For the first part, I think it's something about our primary meaning-making experience of the world. If I ask you to tell me about your day, you're going to roll off a little mini narrative. You're going to tell me about some of the exciting parts. You're going to tell me about some of the boring parts. In our family, sometimes we play a game around the dinner table, high, low, and buffalo. So your high point, your low point, and then something that made you laugh. Well, that's a narrative way of making sense of your life. And so you could make a good case that one of the reasons why narrative is so important to humans is it's the basic framework, the basic lens through which we experience our lives. But I also like what Lewis has to say. He has a great book, Experiment and Criticism. I don't know if you come across this book, but at the end, he talks about the human desire to leave our own world and enter into the world of another. And he imagines this with the language of the reader gaining more eyes. Elsewhere, he's got a place where he says that one of the great benefits of reading other stories, encountering other novels, you could probably add to this film and other forms of storytelling. One of the reasons why we love this is that it makes us spectators of mankind, and he means that in the broadest sense. So that when I open myself to a world of literature, fable, legend, story, I'm really getting a chance to transcend myself, which is pretty important. So there is that kind of ecstatic experience that a story can give you. That's what that word means, ecstatic, to be drawn out of yourself. Stories can do that. And sometimes when you leave the theater after 2.5 hours or you just put down a novel, you really feel like you've lived in a different world for a while. And that's a great pleasure. It's a really great pleasure.
Yeah. So let's move from there then. What role specifically does this play in the Christian life?
That is very important too. Stories make up so much of the scriptural account of the world. It's just that we do have and treasure the epistles of Paul and John and Peter as ways of making sense of what they experienced as disciples, compatriots with Christ in the cause of the Great Commission. But we also do have a lot of stories. You know, like a lot of the first portion of the Bible is storytelling. And that seems to be very important. It seems like our faith is not just reducible to certain ideas, but it's rather an experience that we have grounded within a larger experience of Christian redemptive history. There's this long story of God calling the world to himself, redeeming the world from sin, atoning for the world's transgressions, and Christians can enter into that by way of the Bible and by way of Christian worship and the sacraments. Mm-hmm. So story is something, ideally, that's not just a discrete part of the Christian life, perhaps just something within our Bible reading time or something that we hear from the pulpit for a brief bit. Mm-hmm. But ideally, we're waking up every day and we're trying to find our place within the bigger picture. So that's the scriptural side of things. And then I think in addition to that, we can also think about the value of story within the context of leisure time. So one of the great questions we have to ask ourselves is, what do we do with the hours where we're not working? We're not working on our studies. We're not in a factory somewhere or in an office, but we just have time to ourselves. And there, it seems like story in the realm of entertainment can do us great good, because we expose ourselves through stories to some of the highest ideals. Just to give you an example, every year we like to read Christmas Carol. And I love A Christmas Carol. It's become so familiar at this point that I have favorite parts. I love the dead as a doornail part. I love the part where Dickens describes the onions in the onion basket with the ghost of Christmas present. He calls them winking Spaniards. I mean, it's just outlandish. I love those parts. But the great thing is, I really feel like when I emerge from that experience every year, I have acquired a new sense of gratitude for my own life. I've acquired just a renewed sense of what matters. And I can't put that in the form of a syllogism or an argument, but I feel reminded of it afresh. So choosing good stories, not just any old stories, but choosing good ones that we can make a part of our habitual a time for leisure and enjoyment, can be fun. But in addition to being fun, I think it also reminds us of the most important things. The virtues, so temperance, things like wisdom and justice, but also then sometimes too, some of the highest Christian ideals, like faith, hope, and love, can be experienced afresh, not just as concepts, but as real characters and scenes.
I think taking it back to the scripture from the entertainment, I think it's a significant theological point that one of the most prominent ways that Jesus communicated with people was in the form of stories. That's what the parables were. And, you know, I mean, there were other ways he communicated, but there's always something really poignant about Christ putting the image to the different abstract ideas he's trying to communicate, the different virtues that he's trying to to teach there. I guess this is going a little off script but what do you think we can learn from the parables specifically when it comes to the point you made about discerning what good reading is?
Oh, good. Well, I, not being a biblical scholar, I have a bit of fear and trepidation about the parables, just because they're so they are so interesting. Is it Mark 4 when Jesus says he speaks in parables so that certain people in his audience will not understand? So there's this very mysterious thing about what the parables do. They both clarify certain things, but then they also hide things at times. So I don't know, but certainly certainly the parable is a literary genre. And so to understand the riches of what Jesus is saying in those passages, it's not just like we can download that information directly as though somehow we could translate that message into a series of bullet points or something, but it's a form that we have to learn and to acquire. And I'm still a baby at that particular genre, but I'd like to learn more.
Yeah. So let's go back to entertainment and whatnot. You know, one of the things that you and the English department does is, you know, teach the students how to engage with literature. And, you know, we're a Christian higher institution, so it's generally understood that we do that from a particularly Christian angle. Mm-hmm. So what does it look like to have a distinctly Christian approach to studying and enjoying these great stories that you talk about in your classes?
Yeah. Well, that's a hard one to answer, but I would start here. I had a moment of realization a few years ago that I sometimes share with people. It was a Bible radar going off kind of moment when one day I was trying to put together a plot synopsis for the Odyssey. Have you read the Odyssey or dipped into it before? Okay.
Read both Iliad and Odyssey.
You're good.
Homer is brilliant.
Yes, he is brilliant. It's all downhill after Homer, some of my mentors used to say. Maybe not. It's not exactly true. But I do love in that story, if you go through the plot points, there is some kind of biblical echo going on there. Hmm. So what's the story of the Odyssey? It's the story of a great king who leaves his home to go on a mission and rescue an imperiled bride. To do so, he has to go through all kinds of hardships. He literally has to go to hell and come back. When he does come back to his own people, they don't recognize him. It's almost this John 1, he came to his own did not receive him sort of thing. Finally, he reveals himself. When he does that, he brings justice. He rewards the faithful. And then it all ends in a garden. Mm-hmm. And you say, how is it possible that something that was written 800 years about before the time of Christ could have so many echoes like that? And I think the reason why, Peter Lighthart, one of my favorite theologians, has this great saying. He says, the devil has no stories. Any great story has to borrow from the one true story. So we're always looking for we're looking for echoes, we're looking for these reverberations. Tolkien calls them splinters of light, splinters of truth, because anywhere you find truth, you find his truth. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, then we can go to the great books and try to find wisdom, knowing that these things have lasted not by some chaotic chance, but because there's something in them that doesn't die. And if that's the case, then that just presents, I think, a really refreshing and exciting approach to literature. We're not saying that these things are on par with Scripture, far from it, but there's a Presbyterian minister from the early 20th century, Charles Osgood, who's got a great book called Poetry as a Means of Grace. And in the introduction, he has a fascinating metaphor. He says that secular poetry, he just means anything that's not the Scriptures, secular poetry is like the tree that Zacchaeus climbed to get a better view of Christ. And I think about that often, that it's something which prepares us for the experience of the Scriptures, you know, because grace perfects nature, right? We have to have a deep human spirit in order to encounter Christ deeply within the Scriptures, and literature is something that makes us deeper people.
So on the converse of that, then, what would be a wrong way to do a Christian approach to literature? Because, I mean, you know, with any good interpretation, there's an equally bad way to interpret things.
Seems like you can go wrong in many different ways. Some of the bad ways, you might try to reduce literature to ideas in a certain way so that when I read, say, Frankenstein, I think, oh, well, this is Romanticism. Or I read Voltaire and I say, this is Enlightenment thinking, pure and simple. Or if I read, I'm not actually a huge fan of Hemingway, but if I just say Hemingway is modernism, then what I've done there is I've really tried to obviate the literary form to get at the idea alone. And I do believe the ideas of literature are very important. In fact, they can be life-giving or they can be very misleading. But to try to just look at a literary work as a container of ideas is, I think, a mistake. And maybe this is a mistake that could be easy for some Christians to make because we are rightly concerned about ideas. We think that ideas matter. We think that, in the great phrase from Richard Weaver, ideas have consequences. Mm-hmm. So we're alert and attuned in a good way, but we have to remember that literature is also an experience, and so what the poet or the author is trying to do is give us wisdom through that experience, and perhaps the best way that we could faithfully read a work of literature, the best way we could respond to it is ask, is there any wisdom coming to me through those images? And then approach that with a discerning mind, just as we would approach philosophy or sociology or economics or any other subject matter.
And are there any practical ways or any authors or anything that you would suggest to help listeners and help students thread that needle?
And would that be authors of imaginative literature or maybe commentators
Commentators, okay. like people talking about the philosophy of reading books to help them understand, okay, here's how to do it, here's how not to do it.
Yeah, great question. Charles Osgood, whom I just mentioned, would be one of those thinkers. The rest of the book is gold. I also really love Louise Cowan, who was a literary critic in the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century. She did a great job trying to persuade her own Christian community of the value of literature. And she's got one essay in particular that I'd highly recommend. And it's I think it's called The Necessity of the Classics. She's got two, actually. The Necessity of the Classics, and then the other one, if I'm not botching the title, is What Hath Jerusalem to Do with Athens? So it's picking up on that question from Tertullian. Either one of those are great reads. They're very accessible, and I just think she makes a number of great points in a very winsome way.
Mm-hmm. And as far as the practices of reading, do you think that, like with the advent of audiobooks and with televising all our stuff and all that, do you think there's something we're losing with that? That, like, I don't know, just anecdotally in your experience, do you see reading habits, particularly within the Christian community, dropping off? Because I'd say, at least from my experience, I'm meeting a lot more people these days that don't really bother to read at all.
Yeah, I do think that's happening. When it comes to things like audiobooks, I listen to a lot of audiobooks, and maybe that's just because I'm a busy parent now, that there are certain tasks at home I can do. I can wash the dishes while I listen to an audiobook, that sort of thing. So I'm grateful for that kind of technology.
It's not the same as having
it is not
the
same.
And board
no,
in
you
your
want
hand.
You want the you can't do marginalia. You can't do that kind of thing. So I do think that something is being lost. But I also think a lot about what's the best way to recover. And I'm not sure it's exactly this approach. Well, let's just dive back into the classics. Everybody should start next Monday reading Moby Dick or The Brothers Karamazov or something like that. In fact, when my little playful thing in the bio there about good books, I'm a big fan of this idea of reading good books in preparation for the great books.
Okay.
So you might define good books as texts which have lasted, but don't necessarily try to climb the heights of philosophy and great ideas in the way that, say, something like Cervantes or Shakespeare or some of these other masters.
So what would be an example of a good book?
Great question. Something like Sherlock Holmes, Treasure Island. You could also include in there Dickens. Dickens is maybe borderline between great and good, but also fairy tales, fables, legends, George MacDonald. You can go back to some of the children's books that we used to read, like Beatrix Potter, Winnie
Classic.
The Pooh. Yeah, those books are really good because they give us richness of experience that informs our reading of the great books. My quick example of this would be something like Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. So in book 8 of that treatise, you know, the great philosopher, he talks about friendship, and he talks about it in a fairly abstract way, you know, the way philosophers do. Mm-hmm. He identifies three different types of friendship, friendship according to pleasure and utility and virtue. But it could leave a reader cold. It's philosophy, after all, and if I'm not jiving with what he means by these categories, that could be a little bit troubling. But if I go back and I read Kenneth Graham's The Wind in the Willows, and I experience the friendship of Ratty and Mole and Toad and Badger, and I'm in that world, wow, then I have all these wonderful associations and mental images of friendship that I can bring into my more abstract thinking.
It's like the pleasant experience gives you the baseline for the categories in the more abstract work.
Exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I guess one other thing I really want to hit here, and we could take a good chunk of time to discuss this, but it's the way that morality, like our morality, should engage with stories, particularly stories that have expressly anti-Christian messages. Mm-hmm. So I picked two examples that are particularly relevant to the time in which we're recording this. So Dune, both the book and the movie, for example, have very outright anti-religious messages. So like how do we thread the needle with stuff like that? Is there a way to read pagan, anti-Christian books that still has some sort of edifying value to it?
Yeah. I suppose the answer is always yes, that we can receive stories with a certain frame of mind that is receptive and does not try to use or abuse the literature. However, I do wonder sometimes about the question of, well, practically speaking, the question of time, what we do with our leisure time. So sometimes we ask these questions, could I faithfully watch such and such a movie or read such and such a book and respond to it well as a Christian? Yes, but then there might be this more important question, given that you only have a limited amount of time, what do you fill your soul with? So those two questions, the question in the abstract and then the practical question of what I do today, those are both items to consider, I suppose. Yeah, and there is also a difference between, this is maybe sort of skirting around your question rather than directly answering it, but maybe there is a difference between pagan work and then anti-Christian work. So when I encounter Homer, I still encounter a cosmos that has divinity in it, a cosmos that has nobility in it, heroism, some amount of self-sacrifice, these things. I mean, it's certainly not a Christian world. It's it doesn't have those same ideals, and there's no room for forgiveness. But that's very different from something like Philip Pullman or possibly some of these contemporary writers who have something like an axe to grind. Still, I could read those works with some benefit and enjoy elements of them, and I could do that, and we could talk about maybe approaches and strategies and techniques that would help me make the most of that experience.
Yeah.
But then I also have to ask the question, too, if I have a list of 10 books and it's a mix, then how would I rather spend my time? Would I rather spend my time reading Dune or reading Pilgrim's Progress or reading C.S. Lewis or something like that? Now, maybe I get to read all three, and that works. But oftentimes, we're dealing with a limited amount of time, and the question that Christians don't ask themselves enough, I personally think, I know this is controversial, but a question we don't ask ourselves enough is, what do I do with the time that I have? Because I don't have an unending supply of time.
Yeah, so yeah, that's good. I like that point on discerning how we spend our time. I agree with you. I don't think we really think about that too often. Let's backtrack to a previous point you brought up. So let's say, hypothetically, I'm someone who hasn't read a lot. This is the hypothetical character, not me.
Not you.
As a person. But let's say I've decided to spend my time reading something like Dune that has very anti-Christian messages.
Yep.
How would you go about properly approaching something like that?
Good.
To get back to the point you hinted we could explore more later.
Because I haven't read Dune yet.
Okay.
But Yeah.
Or just so other examples of the like.
Well, I would begin. I would begin by asking some questions about the characters and the main problem that besets the protagonist. So, if you want to find out what an author thinks about the world, this is, I think, the best approach. You see within a story this arc of conflict, or this art of this tension, this this complexity that builds over the story. Things at the beginning, even if the beginning is just the backstory of the main narrative, things at the beginning are in a state of equilibrium, but then a story begins when that equilibrium is upset in one way or another. And it's just a long build until some kind of action at the end resolves the issue and equilibrium is restored. So one great question you could ask is, what is the thing that restores equilibrium? What's the decision? Because that thing, whether it is comic or tragic, however the resolution comes about, that thing says a lot about an author's view of the world. That's also going to be the myth that seeps into my consciousness. That kind of feeling, that kind of atmosphere is going to probably be the residue that I leave the story with. So I like to ask myself that kind of question. A story may be very, very entertaining, but then I can get to the end and I can look back and I can reflect, what is that thing that brings it all to a close, that brings it all to a heading? And and then is that a kind of action? Is that a kind of move that I want to celebrate? Another thing you can think about is it's like characters are what John Truby calls variations on a moral theme. So very often there is a central theme to a story, and each character is a slightly different take on that theme. I'll give you an example of this. And As You Like It by Shakespeare, which is one of my favorite plays.
It's a good one.
It is a good one. It's
underrated.
Underrated, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, yes. That you see the main theme is honor. How do you become an honorable person? How do you become a gentleman? And Orlando at the beginning of that story has a very misshapen understanding of what it means to be a gentleman. And then he encounters different people out in the woods. Duke Sr., who's an exile, but he's got this, even though he has no status, he has this deep sense of dignity. Or you have Jaques, who's kind of a silly person, dismisses the idea of dignity altogether. And you have Rosalind, who ends up being the heroine of the story, and she has a very unique and beautiful view of human dignity. So sometimes it's worth asking, what are the various takes on a theme? And then I can zero in on some of those and ask myself, well, does that show me anything? Does that reveal anything? And it might be that an author has a kind of public agenda against Christianity, but nevertheless, within the story world, within the myth of the novel, ends up affirming a lot of things that we think are really beautiful and important, despite himself or despite herself. We can sometimes find that glory. And that goes back to the Peter Lightheart idea that the devil has no stories. If a story is truly great, it's going to be borrowing on the one true myth, as Lewis would think of it.
Yeah. And one would imagine even the stories that are horrible perversions of the true myth, there's always something that'll inevitably shine through despite the author's intentions.
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's very good, very helpful stuff. I guess on another element here, to take it to the film side of things, Oppenheimer just won Best Picture at the Oscars. The question here is sort of, where do we draw the line with patronizing certain art? Because Oppenheimer is like, it's this very well told story. It's a visual master. Have you seen the movie?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
There are those three scenes where it's kind of very much in your face, graphic nudity and whatnot.
Yep. Yep.
And I ask this because a relative posed the question, this pretty much same question to me, and I wasn't quite sure how to answer it.
Where
do we draw the line with patronizing that? Because, you know, if we're paying for the whole movie, we're paying for the whole movie.
Yep, that's right.
In your face, sinful stuff included.
Yep, that's right. Well, it does help. It does help that now we have websites and things that can alert us to objectionable content.
Mm-hmm. Plugged In's a really good one.
Plugged In's a good one. Internet Movie Database is not a Christian source, but they have that parent's guide function that'll tell you about, it'll just give you warnings about certain elements. So those things are helpful. It's a great question. I would say that we should, think first about, again, the ratio of what we consume. Mm. I go back to a great piece from Lewis where he, I think it's in his introduction to Athanasius, where he talks about this ratio between old books and good books that we have that
this,
we should
would
try
this be
to,
in his introduction to On the Incarnation?
That's it. That's okay. In that book, he talks about how we should alternate back and forth between old books and good books. And and that would be a good practice to adopt with movies, I would think, as well. Things that are new, things that are fresh, but then also to go back to some old classics that we know are worth watching. A lot of the time, if I think back on my movie consumption and cinematic experiences, I can see myself in front of the TV wasting time scrolling for the thing. You know, we spend so much time scrolling for the right thing. When I know that there are Frank Capra movies I haven't seen that would be wonderful to watch, when I know that there are Sergio Leone spaghetti westerns that I could watch that would be a delightful
classics.
Experience. So that would be helpful first is to try to maybe to try to change our diet a little bit. But when it comes to particular films like that, I do think that the most important thing about film is the image. So you could have a kind of philosophical conversation after watching a Martin Scorsese movie that would try to process the worldview of the movie, that would try to tease out some of the moral messages of the film. But the thing that's going to burn in the mind's eye would be the images of that film. That movie is going to make an impression upon you no matter how much you try to distill the wisdom out of it. So I think it's actually a question we have to pay a lot of attention to. And if I'm feeding my soul a lot of heavy material, I'm not making some moral dictum about Martin Scorsese movies. But I think if that's my only diet, and if these heavy, heavy, intense cinematic experiences are my only diet, then that's probably going to do bad things to me over the long run. If, on the other hand, I have a regular diet of good things, I'll probably be pretty well prepared to handle an experience like this where I know I'm going into a film that has some objectionable content, but I've done so much to give nutrition to the soil of my soul that I'm fairly confident that I can receive that in a mature way. And that I can trust that I've got this reservoir of good things ready to play a kind of weed and feed function within my heart.
In some sense, it seems to go back to your earlier distinction between good books and great books. That just like if you take in the good, the true, and the beautiful, that'll build you up in your ability to guard your heart and guard your mind and maturely navigate those waters.
I think so.
Yeah. So just to bring things to a close here, we've given this wisdom to audiences. Hopefully, if someone's listening and they haven't really had an interest in doing this, now they're interested. Where do you start? Books, movies, some of your favorites, some good stuff you think is a great place to start with applying some of these principles we talked about today.
Yep, I would start with reading lists. And and I would start with one of my favorites. It comes from a professor who used to teach at Kansas in the classics department. His name is John Senior, and he was a Christian and wrote a couple of great books. One called The Death of Christian Culture. One called The Restoration of Christian Culture. And in the back of one of those books, I can't remember which one. I think it's Death of Christian Culture. He's got a list of what he calls the 1,000 good books. he's the one who coins this term. So it's a list that's broken down from nursery days to childhood to adolescence to youth. And it's a great reading program. But for those of us who think, you know, I didn't really read a lot as a child, but I would like to catch up, as it were. And I don't think I'm maybe ready to start right away by dipping into Chaucer or something like that, then this good books list is wonderful because it's a source of great literary enjoyment. It's full of pirate stories and mysteries and things like that, but the kind of high-quality stuff that's lasted. Then when we fill our mind with these images of goodness, we can build up to better and better things. I would also say that I would highly recommend that you try to adopt some sort of read-aloud experience within your home, within your family, maybe even with some friends. Maybe the best thing that you could do to solidify your practice as a reader would be to start hosting a book club with your friends. So get a couple of friends together, decide how you're going to rotate between hosting it at your house and then your friend's house. The person who chooses the book gets to cook the meal and host everybody else and goes around that way from month to month. I've been in a book club like this for several years, and it has been one of the biggest blessings to my life as a reader. So those things, right? Not to do it alone, but to really make this an enjoyable part of one's leisure time is, I think, the best way to go about it.
Yeah.
Those would be a few introductory recommendations.
Excellent. Well, very good. Let me just close our episode with this episode's selection from the Heidelberg Catechism. It's Lord's Day 18. Question 46. What do you confess when you say, "He ascended into heaven"? Answer, that Christ, before the eyes of his disciples, was taken up from the earth into heaven, and that he is there for our benefit until he comes again to judge the living and the dead. Question 47. Is Christ then not with us until the end of the world, as he promised us? Answer. Christ is true man and true God. With respect to his human nature, he is no longer on earth, but with respect to his divinity, majesty, grace, and spirit, he is never absent from us. Question 48. But are the two natures in Christ not separated from each other if his human nature is not present wherever his divinity is? Answer. Not at all, for his divinity has no limits and is present everywhere. For it must follow that his divinity is indeed beyond the human nature which he has taken on, and nevertheless is within this human nature and remains personally united to it. Question 49. How does Christ's ascension into heaven benefit us? Answer. First, he is our advocate in heaven before his Father. Second, we have our flesh in heaven as a sure pledge that he, our head, will also take us, his members, up to himself. Third, he sends us his Spirit as a counterpledge, by whose power we seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God, and not the things that are on earth. Dr. Mayo, thank you for coming on the show.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
This has been Keeping the Faith. I am your host, Joseph Wolcott, and I will see you all in the next episode.